What advice do you give women who are trying to build their confidence in this world?
Think of being a woman as an asset. Most of the time you're in rooms with men. Don't think about it like a liability. Don't think you're lesser than or don't get insecure. Mm-hmm. Just go in there and own your shit and know that you can be scared but still walk through the door. As you venture into the world of trying to raise capital or build a business or tell people about your ideas, know that you don't need people's validation to do what you want to do. You need to be willing to work your ass off for a very long time. So I would just say you've got this and just go for it and don't look back.
Welcome to Business Untitled. I think it's episode 23. We're very proud and happy today to have Greg Renfro. She's the founder, a true entrepreneur, founder of Beauty Counter, which to many of us guys out there don't use as products, but she's a disruptor in the cosmetics industry and really is like one of the founders of the concept of clean beauty. She's an activist for environmentalism, women empowerment, safe products, and we're really happy to have
and
her
And our third female guest on Business Untitled. We're committed to having
well
her.
Well done, guys.
A true entrepreneur. So welcome, Greg.
Well done. Thank you for having me.
And I did get Kiehl's. The last female guest gave me a whole Kiehl's was my first beauty product I ever had.
Okay, well, we got to
make like his pitch this is his pitch for something free.
Yeah, well, I'll give you something free. But definitely not Kiehl's. Yeah.
All right.
I was going to say, usually we start with early life a little bit and what motivated people. I know I'd read some things on you and you had some disruptions or early struggles in your life, maybe financially as you described it, and certainly always had an entrepreneurial spirit and drive, it seems, right, from like cleaning companies. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and what kind of created the drive and hunger and confidence in you that you have today?
Well, I think confidence, I'll start with the confidence and then I'll go to the drive. I think the confidence came from my parents, both my mother and father. From the earliest age told me you can be anything you want to be in the world. You can be the president of the United States if you want to be. You just have to be willing to work really, really hard. But don't let anyone ever underestimate you. We were talking a moment ago. I was named Greg, which is my mom's maiden name. So from the beginning, I was always feisty. And it was always having to like prove that I, you know, had confidence and whatever being put at the table with all the boys when I was literally in first grade. So I think that was probably the greatest gift my parents gave me was the gift of confidence, which seems obvious, but to many women, it's not there. No one's telling them that they're good enough when they're young. In terms of my drive, I think I grew up with both of my parents came from very well-positioned families by most standards, and yet when my dad was a big Wall Street block trader, very successful, my mom was not working at the time, but my dad was pretty difficult and arrogant and lost his job, and we became financially unstable pretty quickly. My mom took her 2-year college degree and went back into real estate and became one of the top people in New York real estate. And so I watched them struggle. You know, it wasn't a given that we had money all the time, and it made me really want to stand on my own 2 feet. And so I became pretty resourceful. If I wanted pocket money or I wanted to do things, I knew I had to come up with the money myself. I couldn't depend on my parents. Although, yes, they kept a roof over our heads, and my mom ultimately made enough money to give me a debt-free education, which I'm very appreciative of. But financial instability can get you going.
Mm-hmm. We always ask that question, did you grow up rich, middle class, or poor? And so you kind of had it both.
Yeah.
You kind of grew up rich, and then all of a sudden we're like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the rich went down pretty quickly, so I was still pretty young. But
then your mom brought it back.
But my mom brought
it back,
and she would buy and sell homes.
Shout
she
out
got
to
into
mom.
Real estate. Yeah, my mom has been a huge influence on my life, and she was one of those people, and you see people who fall into challenging circumstances that feel sorry for themselves. She wasn't one of those people. Mm-hmm. She just got on with it and made things happen and provided a great life for me and my brother.
Yeah. I was going to ask, you went to Miss Porter's, right? Which
I
for
did.
High school,
and
boarding
you
school.
You cannot make fun of it.
I'm not
going to
make fun of it.
I was going to make fun of it.
It's all girls.
Yes, it's all girls.
Yeah, I know you know that. I'm just telling our audience. And, I'd like to know, was that an influence? Was that something that shaped you when you look back on it in terms of how confident and successful
what
you
were? What was it 100%. Like?
Yeah, what was it like?
Well, first of all, both of my parents went to boarding school. It was part of our family. They just did that. So I was always going to go to boarding school. I mean, my mom basically said you can either go to the local public high school or you can go away. And once I took a look at schools, I thought, well, this is an incredible opportunity. So I actually looked at 11 boarding schools. Only one was all girls. I chose Porter's. I absolutely loved it all 4 years. It was unbelievable. I think that they feel you have a responsibility as a young woman to shape an ever-changing world and to be, you know, to really have a strong moral compass and to be a person of the world. And I think it gave me the confidence to, I was able to see women as leaders and women who were successful, not in any anti, you know, there was no anti-men situation there. It was just, you've got this. Mm-hmm. And I think it made me the person I am today. Absolutely.
You know, it's funny. I watched the Barbie movie yesterday for the first time, and five minutes in, I was like, I'm not watching this. 20 minutes in, I was glued to it because it was such a good, cool message about women empowerment and watching Ken try to take over, be a man, and they kicked his ass. I was there like, woo, Bobby. But boarding school, it's funny, when we were little, my mom, I would get in trouble in school, and my mom would always threaten me and be like, yeah, you're going to go to boarding school, and I would be so scared.
I don't think the boarding schools in Jamaica were the same.
Wait,
ones
no, this was here.
He's not from Jamaica.
Yeah. What is wrong with you today?
Trinidad.
Took him to my country, and he's calling it Jamaica. And...
Yeah. Literally.
You're on a roll already.
You're on a roll. Are you okay today?
I got any sleep.
He's wearing pink pants.
And then I figured out that I was so scared of this, and then I figured out, wait a minute, mom can't afford boarding school. So yeah. I gave more trouble and I didn't go to boarding school.
Yeah.
And then after that you went to Vermont, mm-hmm. right? How'd that shape you?
I always say I majored in my boyfriend. Yeah. I think after 4 years of an all-girls boarding school, I didn't spend a whole lot of time studying. I was on the way over here talking about how I was just kind of not a very good student. I'm sure I have ADHD, but I wasn't a great college student. Mm-hmm. I partied a lot. I mean, I studied English, which I think gave me a strong foundation in terms of being able to communicate and write well, and I'm a voracious reader, but I really just kind of had fun in college, if I'm being completely honest. But it was, you know, it was great. I mean, it was a beautiful city.
Do you think, like, Vermont's, like, sustainability kind of ethos, like, was something that, you know, kind of filtered into you in a sense? Like, is it this mix of experiences? You know, because, like, Beauty Counter is pretty, you know, like, unique in that way that it's both ethical, it's business model, it's... How do you, you know,
No, you know, it's funny because UVM has now like the top sustainability program in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think for me, actually, it's interesting because when I think about things that shaped me in college, we had a whole tented sort of encampment. You know, it was a bunch of students protesting apartheid in South Africa. Ironically, I ended up marrying a person from South Africa.
You must be my age, even though you look younger.
I'm old, yeah.
Yeah, now I know exactly how old you are because we had that same
I'm 55. Yeah. So anyway, I think that that shaped me more than the environmental initiatives in Vermont. I do remember that quite distinctly, but... Yeah, right. But now, I mean, I think now they're very focused on.
Is Ben and Jerry from Vermont?
Yes,
and Ben and Jerry's was actually.
That was one of the first.
Yes, it was, and it was. They were just starting to explode when I was in college.
Yeah, it was really like almost one of the models for B Corps, right?
Yes.
For these kind of like corporations that go beyond just profitability. I think they were one of the first ones.
They
to
were
kind
one of
pioneer
the first,
that.
and we were early on.
You were a
too.
B Corp as well.
We are a B Corp, and I believe wholeheartedly in that model.
Right. B Corp is what we're talking about with Warby Parker guys.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, in terms of
I know
of
those
like,
guys well. Yeah.
Can we explain to our audience what is B Corp?
A C Corp, or you know, the traditional form of corporation, profit, really shareholders' return and profit is the only thing that's allowed to be considered by the board and the management. And with a B Corp, you're allowed to consider employees, stakeholders, community, things like that. So it gives you more latitude
right.
to be, yeah, the environment.
Triple bottom line.
Right.
And
is that, am I correct with that?
It's not even the opportunity. You actually, as a board, your fiduciary responsibility requires you that if you're in a sale process or whatever, that you actually have to look at these things and weigh them out. You can't just go for the highest price if they're not ethically and responsibly sourcing or they're not treating workers
right.
well. I believe that this is where we need to go mm-hmm. when I think about the capital markets, showing that companies can do well and be financially successful and not, you know, decimate the earth, take care of people. I mean, this is really, really important for our future.
Definitely. And we talk about this a lot on here, you know, about like just pure rapacious capitalism versus like balance of that. Right, Mike?
Yeah. No, yeah. Growing up with my sister, I have a sister who runs a thing called Acumen Fund, but my whole life, it's been, you know, how do you help the bottom, you know, it used to be the 3 billion people that lived at the bottom of the pyramid, right? We said in 1995, there were 3 billion people on the planet that made less than $3 a day. Today, that's less than 900 million. So, like, but it's like, how do you create ethical companies, you know?
Right. Because not-for-profits can only do so much effectively, right? You need to harness the power of
how do you find ethical leaders? How do you find moral leaders?
Yeah.
Not easy.
Yeah.
No, it's not easy. And actually, it's funny you say that because I do think that it's not easy to do, but it's absolutely possible. And consumers are demanding of companies that they do better, and they are rewarding companies that are doing better. Mm. And so I do think it's a real opportunity for all businesses today.
Uh-huh.
But you have to drive profits. I mean, I also don't believe in the model which has been very prevalent in the consumer markets over the last decade or so, which is growth at all costs, but it doesn't matter if you're hemorrhaging cash. I mean, that's not sustainable either.
Right. So I want to talk about just, I know you had many experiences before Beauty Counter, right? You founded that 10 years ago, 11 years ago?
I started Beauty Counter. I started concepting it in late 2010. We launched in March of 13. It took a couple of years to get it going.
And so what brought you to that moment, you know, prior experiences, or what was your aha moment? How did you, you know?
Watch the documentary. Right?
Yes, I did. It started in 2006. I was living here in New York and was running a clothing company for Tommy and Susie Hilfiger, and my friend encouraged me to watch An Inconvenient Truth. And it was the first time that I became aware of the fact that I was doing things that were detrimental to the earth, and I really quickly became impassioned with the environmental health movement. And over the next 2 years, and you all have experienced this as well, I watched so many people I love get sick. Friends of mine were being diagnosed with different types of cancer. My friends were struggling with fertility issues, having to use surrogates to bring kids into the world, and or just giving birth to kids with really serious health issues, you know, ADHD, autism, asthma. And I thought, what's gone so terribly awry with the health of the earth and human health? And one of the things that I learned is that we're being exposed to lots of toxic chemicals, and they're omnipresent. And so I started to make a lot of changes, and that was easy to do in a lot of areas, like getting rid of plastic containers or washing my floors with, you know, water and vinegar instead of, you know, what I've been using. But when it came to personal care products, skincare products, makeup, anything like that, there just weren't any products that met my needs in the market. There were all the incumbent brands who were aspirational and high performance, and, you know, we've all grown up with them and loved them, but they were filled with chemicals of concern. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of the spectrum, they had all these very eco, earthy things. I mean, you said it a moment ago, you know, about nonprofits. That type of product line only appeals to a small segment of the population. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why can't we have a commercially viable product that is high performing and significantly safer? And instead of doing this as sort of creating a movement that's a nonprofit movement, mm-hmm. let's do it. Let's do it in a commercial way, which is what we did.
And I read this somewhere, and I'm hoping that it's not true because it sounds so crazy. The U.S. has 30 ingredients that are banned versus the UE, versus Europe that has 1,400.
Mm-hmm.
Is that actually true?
That is actually true.
That's insane.
Now, not all 14 of those are commonly used in personal care products, but yes, when I started Beauty Counter, we had not updated major federal law governing the industry. And when I talk, I just would be clear, because I know a lot of your listeners are men, because you don't have very many women on this program. So here's the deal. When I talk about cosmetics or personal care, I'm talking about your shaving cream, your deodorant, your sunscreen, your bubble bath. It's everything. It's not women's lipstick. Yeah. I mean, it is women's lipstick, but it's anything that falls under the category of personal care. We had not updated federal legislation governing that industry since 1938. And the U.S. had only banned 11 chemicals when I started Beauty Counter. Now we're up to a whopping 30, whereas the EU bans or restricts 1,400.
And you're trying to get it to 2,800.
We're trying to get, well, we have a never list, which we were the first company to publicly publish what we call our never list, which we trademark, which is a list of ingredients that we know cause harm to health that we do not use in our formulations.
Give us a couple of examples.
Formaldehyde.
That's intuitive.
Phthalates.
Right?
Phthalates are, it's intuitive, but you'd be surprised, and it shows up in sort of ways that you might not know. An example would be phthalates. So phthalates are a class of chemicals that very closely mimic the endocrine system, and because they closely mimic it, your body doesn't necessarily know to reject it. And that those phthalates are used in all perfumes, scents, anything to bind it to your skin. It's in your car, new car smell. It's in vinyl shower curtains. But that, so when you think about fragrance, which is $1 in $4 spent in beauty, and it's in everything, right? It's in our lotions, our shampoos. That's one that's a super offensive chemical, a class of chemicals that are widely used.
So how do you, let's assume he's making his perfume with phthalates. Phthalates? Is
it? Phthalates.
Phthalates. And you're going to make perfume without it. How are you going to recreate the smell, the scent?
So it's not so much about the scent. It's about creating how it sticks to you. And, yeah, we used cedarwood. And there are a whole bunch of ingredients, and I'm not a chemist. So, but we used a bunch of ingredients that drove the performance that we needed without using phthalates. You know, there are a lot of parabens, methylparaben, ethylparaben, oxybenzone in sunscreen, killing the coral reefs, horrible for your body. Don't use those clear spray sunscreens. They're just terrible for the environment, the coral, yourself.
Remember we were down at Bacalar at Hoppin' House? No sunscreen allowed?
Yeah. How do I not go coral. Home and just not throw everything out my...
No, it's in Mexico.
Oh, because we really focused with Hawaii on the safer sunscreen, but like Hawaii is very focused on it because they started to see like a sheen all around Maui and stuff, and they were realizing it was killing, which tourism is obviously extremely important for Hawaii and the environment. So they banned all non-mineral sunscreens.
Yeah.
So this has really got to be like a federal approach where you put a think tank together and say, okay, we're going to, and it's got to be phased in if you want to really make change. Otherwise, because if you snap your fingers, you just put everyone out of business, which would be kind of nice for you. But
no,
it's not the way the world works.
Been legislating on the Hill quite a bit, right, and been passing laws, basically regulations in this.
So Beauty Counter, we started it as a community-based sort of underground movement. So when I decided that I wanted to launch this product line, I thought, how am I going to bring these products to market, knowing that the incumbents controlled all the shelf space and didn't want the story to get out. And so I actually took a look at the direct selling industry and traditional retail, which is where I'd grown up, in e-commerce, and we created an omni-channel community-based model. I really do believe in community-based commerce. And we created a platform upon which women could build businesses with us and also advocate alongside of us. And so when I was running the company, when I was CEO before, I'm now CEO again, but when I was CEO for the first 8 years, we had about 65,000 women, and we utilized them as not only customer acquisition vehicles, but amplification vehicles for us. And they have advocated with us on the state level, federal level, in parliament. We've hosted over 2,000 meetings on the Hill, and we've helped pass 16 pieces of legislation, including MOCRA. We were very front and center in MOCRA, which is the first time we've updated federal law since 1938.
That's really cool that you're able to mobilize all those, you know, advocates, right, and community, you know, people in your organization. Because otherwise, if it was just your voice, it probably would have been a lot harder to get that kind of response. Would that be
Yeah, I mean,
true?
We all know that members of Congress have to answer to their constituents. Yeah. And these women, you know, again, every single person in this room has been touched directly or indirectly by the health issues we face. And so it's very personal for people. And so, you know, people want to participate in their democracy. They want to lend their voices to issues that matter. And certainly women who are dealing with kids who are sick or friends with cancer, or they themselves have been ill, or they want this to change. So we've been really, really focused on advocacy as a core tenet of our business and our brand.
So you said just now you was CEO and now you're CEO again. So you built this amazing company, sold it to, I think, the Carlyle Group. They restructured it. And they asked you to step down, or did you just step down?
They made the decision to have me step down.
And then
2 years ago.
I'm just assuming they realized we fucked up and they asked you to come back. How was that selling part of this amazing company you built, being asked to step down, and then later on, what was that emotion like? And then later on, them coming back and saying, hey, by the way, we really need you. Can you describe both of those?
And I can, kind of. So, yes, I mean, selling my business to the Carlyle Group was, as a female entrepreneur, to sell a business valued at $1 billion, which in the you know, in the cosmetics industry is a huge valuation. So it was an incredible honor. I was incredibly excited. You know, my goal was to continue to build on this business and to IPO it. When I sold the company, the business slowed. It was the summer after the world kind of opened up. It was summer of 2021. And I think that people maybe felt that we needed a older school executive from the beauty industry. And so they brought someone in to a man to run the business who had been previously at Shiseido. That has not been as successful as they had hoped. And so I have been brought back in to be the CEO again to really rebuild the business into what it has the potential to be.
Did you feel like, were you emotionally like at the time when they asked you to, was it a surprise? Did you know it was coming? Like, did you feel like, wait, what is even like, what was that feeling like?
Here's how, well, I shouldn't start this on the podcast. I mean, it's kind of like this. I'll put it into human terms. So you're happily married and in love with your spouse and thinking you're going to go the distance. And then they decide they don't want to be married to you anymore because they've met someone who's younger and sexier. And so you have to go in front of the family to all the weddings with your kids and smile and make sure that everyone thinks that you're happy. But, of course, you're dying inside. And then they realize that they're maybe not as so in love with the younger person. And so then they come back to you and say, let's make our family work again. Just as you got over it. There you go. That's what it feels like.
That's
so kind of shitty.
That's the best answer we've had on this so far.
That's a really good answer. Was there a part of you that was like, maybe not? Or you just
coming back?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
But now I just want to prove that I'll be the next Steve Jobs and that you guys are going to be talking about this in 10 years, that, you know, someone was underestimated, this woman, and she came back and once again, you know, led the business super successfully.
Do you think women in general are underestimated in the business force?
Yes. Well, I think that women do themselves a disservice of walking into rooms and thinking that they are a liability versus an asset. Being a woman is a liability. I think that we are both patronized and underestimated consistently, and we also play into it and we allow for it. So it's a combination. Women aren't necessarily really good to other women in business because they're trying to prove themselves to men. But I can tell you, right before I came here, I was on a text chain with a group of women with whom I used to work, because I have a business idea that I'm going to do about men in business and the stupid things they say to us women all the time. And someone said that they got a call.
Is Mike Novogratz on that
list? No, maybe. We'll see how you guys do. And this woman was saying that this friend of mine who's also CEO said another woman who's a kick-ass CEO had gotten a call saying that they thought that she was the right person for the job because they liked her personal style. And the woman said, and I know I'm going to have to pay $20 or $100, whatever. The woman on the text chain was like, what the fuck? Like, you would never say that to a man. Like, we're going to hire you because of your personal style. I mean, maybe if you're Tom Ford for a fashion business, but for a business that's not in fashion.
Yeah.
And then they went on
it's
to say, the other
crazy.
Person got a call, literally, CMO, top CMO, huge company, just got a call from a recruiter saying that the company that wanted to talk to her, and I'm literally not making this up, because they thought she could be really helpful at redecorating the corporate offices. And when you say stuff like that, you've got to be kidding yourself.
Yeah.
And if I can give you one piece of advice, which women, the one thing you could stop saying to women in general as men, and maybe you don't, is none of us like to be to hear the phrase in other words. We got it. If we don't understand what you said, we'll ask you otherwise. Just assume we understood it the first time you said it. You don't need to say in other words because we're not stupid.
Yeah.
And I think that happens a lot. And so, you know, it's a combination, to be honest.
What advice do you give women who are trying to build their confidence in this world? Like, that's the man's side. You know, how if you're up and coming or trying to start a business, how do you deal with that?
I just spoke at a women's thing this morning about, we were talking about, you know, investing in female founders and entrepreneurs. I think at the end of the day, one, I always say, like, think of being a woman as an asset. Most of the time you're in rooms with men. Don't think about it like a liability. Don't think you're lesser than, or don't get insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Just go in there and own your shit and know that you can be scared but still walk through the door.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't have to have a chip on your shoulder, because women do a lot of the time have a chip on their shoulder, and they're also scared to be direct. We're scared to talk about money.
Mm-hmm.
We're scared to just say, actually, I can command the salary and this is why. Mm-hmm. We're scared to ask for a raise. And so we're partially responsible for this. And so I want women to know that they've got everything they need to be successful. They just got to walk through the door.
Yeah. That's a big point, like scared to talk about money, right? Like in that context. Like, I mean, just focusing on that for a second. But that men are much more comfortable in general talking about their money, their salaries, their things, and it's probably pretty deep. I don't know, you listen, know you, better
Dave's,
why, but
Dave's got two young sons and a daughter who are friends with my two young daughters and two young sons, and it's shocking to see the boys who are now 26. You know, they know exactly what each guy gets paid, what their salaries are, how he did on his bonus. You know, it's there's a money culture. They gamble together, they sports bet together, they crypto together. The girls, there's none of that, none of it. And so even from a young start, and these were privileged kids who went to good schools, prep schools, and good colleges, it's just, it is such a different way they interact with each other.
Well, it's funny you say this. So I was in this breakfast this morning, and we were talking about how there's a woman who was at Goldman, very successful investor. She's married to one of the founders of one of the top private equity firms. And she was saying that she met a female founder, wanted to invest in her business. And so she thought, no problem. Like, we'll get you $500,000. Let me call my friends, all of whom had real, you know, access to significant amounts of capital. She called all these women up, and she was able to raise $100,000. And she's like, you've got to be kidding me. Her husband said, she said, I just want you to try this. Send a text out to a bunch of your friends. Same dinner, same moment. He raised $1 million in the same amount of time. And it's interesting because women apologize for spending. Women get scared to talk about it. I always says, my husband will go buy a car without asking me, which is fine. But if I, but I wouldn't, even though I earn a lot of money, would not go buy a car without talking to my husband about it. Not that I ask for his permission, because I definitely don't. But also, one of the problems is that when talking about money is that oftentimes the women aren't the breadwinners. Mm-hmm. So it's very uncomfortable to talk about it. And women are considered to be bitches when we are direct and talk about money. You're considered to be tough. Instead of, it's not feminine to talk about money or to be super direct. But the reality is, it's, we can own our power too. But we have to begin. The world has to give us permission to talk about these things and to be direct and strong and not be considered to be a tough bitch. I mean, really, it's a hard. It's a I weird conundrum.
Hard line. It is.
Do you want to replace Mike on this show?
No.
We need it.
No, we need a woman on this show, a co-host.
That's a good
no, but
idea.
You know what? I can relate to that, too, because I, like, obviously I'm black. And
really? I didn't know that.
I'm just saying.
Like, and we just thought that you had a good shirt.
No, but, you know, and I had to learn, like, you know, growing up poor and coming into these circles, I had to, like, always... I had to figure out, don't be afraid to talk about money. And I even, something happened recently, and Mike had to remind me that, like, don't be afraid to talk about money, right? And sometimes, a lot of times, I had to learn to, that being black, even though we've had so many things that has worked to disadvantage, at times I have to use it to my advantage. And that's something that I could relate to because... it's something I had to learn and get the confidence to do it. And sometimes I'm still like, oh my God, I shouldn't be in this room. I'm a high school dropout. And I have to remind myself, or sometimes Dave or Mike have to remind me, look, you're successful. It doesn't matter what, you know, if you 100%. Went to high school, if you didn't, what a community you grew up in. But it still kind of lives in you. So I understand exactly what you're saying. And it's something to this day I struggle with. But at times I remember, I have to remember, use it with confidence, and it's okay. You're good enough to be in this room. You could talk about money, and you know. So I do relate to that, and I understand that fully well.
Yeah.
Not a woman, but I am black. In case anybody.
Yeah, you're such a sensitive guy too.
I was gonna ask with Beauty Counter, when you message that, right? There's a few things going on at once, which is my personal health. Right. Part of what's powerful about that is like, I don't want to put stuff that's going to kill me. Right. In effect, there's environmental health. That's often a tougher thing to sell. Right. It goes in some box, fuzzy box or whatever. And then there's like somewhere in between. And I guess it would go more in environmental health. But like fast fashion, the equivalent of that in fast cosmetics or fast skincare or whatever you want, fast beauty. Is that same paradigm exist that exist, say, in fashion or in other 100%. Industries? Yeah.
Well, I mean, interesting, because fast fashion is one of the things that I publicly swore off, and or I make my daughters plant trees is Zara and some of these things.
Yep.
Because they are, you know, when you look at it, I mean, there's a documentary on this. I'm spacing the name right now, but it talks about, you know, we always say, well, we're just going to donate these clothes. But there's like landfill all over the world in these third world countries that cannot handle, there's nowhere else to put these clothes. And, you know, it used to be that in the States, something like 67% of clothes were made in the U.S. And we would invest in pieces that we would keep for a decade, a nice suit or something. If you bought a jacket, you'd spend $1,000 on it. But instead of buying 10 $100 jackets, you buy one and you keep it the whole time. And I think that has, you know, permeated culture in a way that is really not good for anyone.
Yeah.
And I also always say to people, and it's true of cosmetics as well, but let's use the idea of like a white t-shirt. And this goes back to that film, or, you know, a lipstick for $5. Really, was that person paid a fair wage? You had to buy the raw materials. You had to ship the raw materials. Mm-hmm. You had to package them. You had to put packaging around it. You had to ship it across the world and get it into stores who mark it up by at least usually double.
Yeah.
And yet it was only $5. So that person that started at the beginning of this whole, you know, supply chain, did they get paid? No, of course not. They get paid nothing. And, you know, when you talk about the environmental impact of fast fashion or in beauty as well, what you're finding is, you know, what we're spraying on crops, the pesticides around the world to increase productivity of crops. It's, you know, you go to countries, you know, in Asia, Southeast Asia and stuff that are producing a lot of these these garments, and people are getting sick because they're being exposed to all these things. So it is a real problem. And it's trying to strike the balance. I mean, I think for me at Beauty Counter, I've always wanted to educate, to arm people with information so they can make informed choices, not to try to be negative or to point fingers or to scare people. Just say, like, this is the real of what's happening. Here are some solutions that we've created through product. Help us use commerce as an engine for change, and then help us advocate for, you know, more regulation so that all, you know, that people are ethically and responsibly sourcing palm oil, as an example. You know, showing people that there's a path forward, we need to do that. And but it's very true. In fashion, beauty, we have the consumerism. It's like it's about new and it's about cheap, and we got to stop that.
Yeah.
Well, I am completely fucking afraid. I could literally feel my melting through my skin, my lotion, like...
You've never met someone that uses more lotion than Mel.
Okay, well, I should have brought some today. I'm sorry.
He is the king of lotion.
I'm going to send you to our store on Prince Street in the city, and I'll get you some lotion.
Also, hypochondriac.
Whenever we travel, we fly to New Orleans, we fly to Memphis. The first stop is the Duane Reade, so we can buy a giant thing of lotion.
And a toothbrush, which usually forgets.
Well, if you're buying lotion, and for everyone out there, all joking aside, because I know that a large portion of your audience is men, you should, if nothing else, shop fragrance free. So many of the worst and most offensive chemicals are found in fragrance because they're protected under international IP law. No one has to disclose what goes into any of the scents in anything. And also deodorant, you do not want deodorant with aluminum in it, because men are getting breast cancer all the time now, if you think about, and where it shows up right next to.
Wow.
So, you know, use a safer non-aluminum deodorant.
I'm definitely calling you the next time I go, like, food shopping, beauty
I'll
shopping.
I'll send you some products.
Or, Mel, you can just do what I do and use no products.
Or you can do that, too.
That's what I do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not like, it's crazy. Yeah.
No. It's not, you know, I'm really interested because it's not immediately intuitive that the stuff you put on your skin is as
like
bad as what you're ingesting, right? So we're naturally inclined to think about food poisoning. It hurts, you know, but this is something that you really don't see, you don't feel, and just hits you over time.
And in slow motion.
How much time does it take for these chemicals to actually hit you? Is it like, it's different for everyone, or over 10 years, or
yeah, look,
five
I don't
years.
Think we really know exactly. We know that a lot of what we put on our body is absorbed into our skin. And just to be really clear, there are plenty of chemicals that are totally safe.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of natural ingredients that are unsafe and natural ingredients that are safe. And, you know, if you think about something absorbing into your skin, if you've ever sat in a bathtub and you get really, like, wrinkled, prune-like skin, that's because it's absorbing, your skin's absorbing things. So what I think what's scariest about the chemicals in skincare, as an example, something that absorbs versus, like, a rinse-off conditioner in your hair, is that what people don't think about is it's maybe not a big deal what was in your sunscreen, let's just say. But it's the sunscreen combined with the, let's say on a woman's face, it's the sunscreen combined with the tinted moisturizer, with what you brush your teeth with the deodorant that you put under your arm, with the hairspray that you just put in your hair. You put all these things together, no one's testing the combination. So, and again, it's not that all ingredients are going to kill you or that it ever will make your cells unhealthy, but we do know that there is a direct link between certain chemicals that are widely used and major health issues. Mm-hmm. And it is personal. And your point on the environment, that's, I think, why we talked a lot about, and typically if it's safe for health, it's safer for the earth. So they tend to go hand in hand mm-hmm. because the earth and the environment, even though we live in it, like it's always out there for us.
Yep.
And it is inconvenient, which is why that title was so perfect for an inconvenient truth. It's mm-hmm. it's inconvenient to recycle or to do all these things, but it is impacting your health.
Yeah.
What other beauty companies have taken your lead? Any?
Well, you've seen companies like Sephora and Ulta, the large retailers, and when we were represented at Sephora, where they have created clean standards, and what they've done is taken a list of ingredients and asked a certain segment of them if they want to be considered to be clean to show that they've taken, you know, certain chemicals of concern out of the products, and that's kind of the first step in clean. You know, there are a lot of companies that haven't done anything about it. And then there's some other companies out there, you know, that we're friends with that have taken great steps. There's another skincare brand called True Botanicals as an example. You know, there's Michelle Pfeiffer's line, Henry Rosa fragrance line. Like, there are people that have taken it seriously. And those, if you're ever questioning and just and want to understand what's out there, you can always go to the Environmental Working Group's Skin Deep database. They have a database of about 80,000 products. And you can look and see, okay, type in whatever you're using and see how it rates on the toxicity level, and you'll know if it feels safe to you or not.
What do you think of the Fenty's and the
Kylie Jenner's line?
Kylie Jenner? Yeah, what's the name of her brand?
She does have a line. It's called Kylie, I think. I think that Fenty has really positioned itself in terms of inclusivity and having a really, really robust shade range. Their positioning is not about sustainability or clean. That's just not the platform upon which they've built that brand. It's really been about making sure that they're for all women, because Black and brown women in general have way less product available to them, and people haven't always invested in matching their skin tone. And I think in terms of Kylie, I think that she is working towards clean. I don't know exactly. I don't really pay a lot of attention to others. I mean, this is maybe a smart strategy or not, but I kind of just put my blinders on and I focus on what Beauty Counter is doing and the core tenets of our brand and our proposition and what we promise to consumers, because I could get very caught up in what people are claiming to do or not doing. And it's just, and I also just don't want to be a brand that's pointing fingers. I just want to be like, look, let me lead by examples and hope that others will follow. Yeah. And they have.
Yeah. I think that's a really important thing about business in general, which is like, sometimes I'll get that question. I'm sure you get that question, which is, oh, like, who are your competitors? What are they doing? And the truth is, like, I just don't even think about that most of the time. I mean, to some degree, you have to, but you're really so focused on your mission and what you believe in, right? In a sense that it almost isn't in the thought process, right? You have to believe in yourself and your mission. Do you?
Yeah, I think you have to focus on what you're bringing to the market and what is the moat that you're creating around your brand, your business, whatever. I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the competition. I don't really care. I care about is, am I building a product and a business that people want to participate in whatever way? And that, I don't care if that's in finance or beauty. I mean, I always say there's only one business any of us are ever going to be in, and that's the business of people. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the business we're in. So it really doesn't matter that you didn't go to college. Like, are you emotionally intelligent? Do you know how to communicate and build teams and lead? It's not so much about whether you're selling music or real estate or, you know, whatever whether you're mm-hmm. a hedge fund or whatever. You know, it doesn't really matter. And I think that people who spend their time like me tooing and copying other brands, like they never really build anything that's all that great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I doubt that Patagonia spends all their time thinking about Land's End and whatever. They're just thinking, okay, well, like, this is what we do at Patagonia and we're going to stay true to the mission of this company.
I mean, if you think about it, right, leading people, selling product, right, your people are selling it, like they have to believe in you, they have to believe in the company, and that means you're taking them in that direction. The minute you start looking at, what's this guy doing, and don't have that confidence and that belief anymore, you pop the myth or the bubble, right, of belief in what you're doing in terms of how you're changing the world, the product, it's not going to work for you. So it, like, directly equates, I think, to, like, leading people. And you lead a lot of people, it sounds like, if you have 60,000 people that are, like, advocating for your product, right? So they need to believe that you got this and you're going, you know, that you guys are changing the world.
Storytelling.
It's funny you say that. I just came off of a call with the private equity firm, and we're talking about where how do you grow Beauty Counter today, you know, knowing that the market has matured and there are a lot more clean beauty products, whether they are or not, doesn't matter. It's sort of a phrase that's out there. And I think that certainly in consumer, but just in general, you build brands on the power of storytelling. You tell an authentic, no bullshit, transparent story about what you believe in and what you're, what, and you have to operationalize your brand promise, in my opinion. You can't be saying one thing and doing something else. But I think storytelling is incredibly important. And I think people emotionally attached to people, to their stories, to the stories behind the product, I think it's incredibly important. And I think this idea of community-based commerce, of, you know, community and client being one and the same, does go to emotional connection, and that comes through storytelling. And I think we have lots of opportunities today.
And you advertise how?
We don't really, I mean, we've, you know, we've done some advertising over the years, like performance marketing, like other DTC companies. But in general, we have this community of women who have represented us as, you know, salespeople and as advocates, and they typically amplify things. So we'll put bite-sized pieces of content out there and help them amplify it for us. I mean, we've done things like put a full page ad in the Times saying, you know, if you think we're just selling lipstick, you're not paying attention. You know, we'll do that thing from time to time. We've done wild postings from time to time. But what I really think is things that matter are stories that people can relate to. And just being human as a brand, I think, is how you should market your product. You know, I think actually in your world of finance or whatever, and I know crypto now, but one of the things I think is super interesting in the whole financial world is that what do any of those brands stand for? How do you differentiate between one private equity firm and another? I don't know, but I think actually there's a huge opportunity for people to start telling different stories, even in markets that seem
that way. Well, crypto is interesting because crypto is about narrative, right? Like in Bitcoin, there's been a group of people, and it's growing and growing, that have told this mythology and this story about Bitcoin and where it came from and why it's important. And so the whole thing is a social construct that starts from narrative, and the other coins as well. But you're right on, you know, Goldman Sachs versus Morgan Stanley. Man, Goldman Sachs, I spent 12 years there. We used to always say, well, it's about trust. We want our clients to trust us, to think we're the smartest guys in the room. And, you know, they work really hard to build that trust.
Yeah.
And once you build that trust, people don't even care what you charge them. You can actually, you know, you have okay results and charge them more because people trust you. No one gets fired for dealing with Goldman Sachs, or at least you used to not get fired before they became the vampire squid. but yeah, it's interesting because your point of how do you connect, and it is all about story and trust. That's it.
Trust is really important, and we've at Beauty Counter, you know, I say we're going to be what you can count us for is transparency. So if when you purchase a product, we're going to tell you what's in it. You might not like the ingredients, but at least you'll know. And when we've had problems or when we see things and we're trying to create systemic change but we don't have the answers, like when we realized that there were children mining the mica that we were using because we actually physically went and audited the mines, we told that story. We found little children who were 4 and 5 years old in India, in Brazil, mining for mica for all of our cosmetics but also all of our cars and everything else that mica goes into. And instead of just saying, oh, we're going to use synthetic mica and move away from it and pretend like it didn't happen, we're like, no. We saw a discrepancy
That's
in data.
Pretty cool.
We came in there. We partnered with local nonprofits. They need these jobs to put food on the table. There is no other opportunity. So help us as an industry tell the story so that people, you know, can support these communities. Transparency is such an overused term, but it's not often operationalized. Like people say they're going to be transparent, but they aren't all the time. And I think that people want to hear the stories. And trust is critically important. And part of that is just not bullshitting people.
Right.
So to take it back a little bit, you went to college. You had fun in college. Where was like your first, wow, you know what? I'm going to create a business. Like where did that idea first come from and how did you go about doing it?
Well, I started, like my first business idea was I started a cleaning company on Nantucket, whatever. But I wanted to go on this thing called Semester at Sea, and my mom couldn't afford it. So she said, I can pay your regular tuition, that's all, but I'm tapped out. And so I wanted to see the world. I'm really curious about
how
the
world.
How
was Semester at Sea?
It was so fun. I mean, it was beyond its best 3 months of my life. I mean, 700 kids on a boat going around the world. Like being let, you know, starting in Vancouver and ending up in Japan and then just being let loose. I mean, it was.
And you guys were 18 years old?
Yeah. I mean, it was so fun. I mean, I had the best time ever. Uh-huh. I mean, it was ridiculous. But anyway, I learned a lot. I mean, I actually fell in love with Hong Kong, and I remember writing my mom a letter, and I'm like, I'm going to live in Hong Kong. And I did. It really has influenced my
life. What year
were
you in Hong Kong?
I was there from 94 to 95. I was there for 1 year.
Were you there? Yeah.
I was there. We were together.
Oh, really?
No way.
I was there from 94 to 99.
Oh, wow. That's so funny. With Goldman?
Yeah.
Well, we probably were out in Lan Kai Fung at the same time. That was like the best for me. There were, if you were, you know, as you were a white woman out there, like you felt like a goddess. I got back to States. I was like, okay, I'm not as cute as I think I thought I was. But, you know, that year out there, I felt like a goddess every single night. Yeah, it was really, really fun because there were just hardly any women out there that were not, you know, from Hong Kong. But anyway, I think that was like the first thing. So I started this cleaning company. I figured I could charge cash, $20, you know, an hour under the table, and I paid everyone $10. And I walked off the island with thousands and thousands of dollars, which paid for me to go on semester to sea. And then fast forward, you know, I went to work for Xerox because I wanted to have a sales training program because I literally graduated and my mom gave me a check. My mom gave me a monogrammed briefcase and a check for $5,000 and said, you're on your own, which was nice of her. It was actually the best thing she ever did for me. But I racked up credit card debt, was out of cash within a couple months, and she looked at me and she said, well, get a new job. So I went to Xerox, and I did that, and I learned how to be a really effective salesperson by being a really good listener. Hmm. I was assigned the jewelry district in New York City, which was like – no one buys copiers there, and I figured it out. And then
They're all Hasidic Jews.
Yes, and they were, and they like would laugh at me. I mean, but I learned how to negotiate with these guys. And what I finally realized is that when I finally was like, fine, fuck it, I don't want the business. They were like, okay, here, we'll sign. I mean, and then once I got that, then I mastered it, and I became one of the top salespeople. But in terms of businesses, you know, I started a bridesmaid's dress company because I was tired of all these awful dresses that we had to wear, which was not successful. I mean, it wasn't. But it brought me to when I went to London, I met a woman who had started a wedding registry concept there. And I thought, wow, if we could incorporate the internet, this could be really cool. I know this dates me, but the truth is I was trying to convince men that the $35 billion wedding industry was worth investing in. And by the way, the convenience of online purchasing. I mean, it's crazy, but no one was buying wedding gifts online. I mean, no one would ever go to a store to buy a wedding gift today. You'd just say, I want to spend $100. What's in my price range? Yeah. Check it off the list. So that was my first thing, and I sold that company to Martha Stewart.
Martha Stewart, shout out.
Back to Martha Stewart.
Martha.
Shouting, yes. Martha
is coming on this.
You get on the call. You ask her about Greg Renfrew, and you can ask her about the wedding list.
And I'm going to ask her about her house.
I'm in hip-hop, so I got to ask. You guys got a little kind of beef?
No, we don't have a beef. I mean, look, I think that...
Martha
was...
You don't know Martha. I'm convinced at this point.
Here's what I will say about Martha. Martha, if you come on this podcast, I will tell you this.
She's here.
She did an exceptional job, and she continues to do an exceptional job of making an sort of the average middle-class American woman. She made her look like a goddess in her home on things that matter to her on a budget. Helping her, you know, put together a beautiful dinner, which was important at the time, helping her be a better cook, helping her figure out how to make a holiday, you know, whether it was Hanukkah or Christmas, look beautiful on a budget. She did that unbelievably well. She's incredible with content. And she's actually been incredible the fact that, you know, she was a Sports Illustrated at 80 and a bit. I mean, good for her, right? Uh-huh. She was a very tough old school leader and a lot of yelling and, you know, not a lot of listening. And I think that it wasn't that we had a beef. When she would say things like, who picked that yellow color in the shirt, everyone else would cower, and I'd say, Martha, you did yesterday in the meeting down the hall. And she didn't really like that much. So that was why we probably didn't get along as well. But she probably respects me, and I respect her, too.
I love that answer. Snoop likes her a lot.
Who picked that shirt, Mel?
Virgil. This is one of his first shirts at Louis Vuitton.
Wow. It's a good-looking shirt. It is a good-looking shirt.
So it's like a special shirt. Shout out
to him. That is special. That is really special.
R.I.P. Virgil.
Mike's so quiet.
I got some cool questions.
Mike's.
So when you actually figured out you made it, what was like one of the first really nice things you did? Whether it was extravagant, whether it was luxury, whether it was taking your family on a trip, whether it was just buying a fast car or the nice watch that you're gonna get next week. What was like your aha moment? Like, I made it. I'm gonna do something really cool
for myself.
Yeah. Oh, for myself.
Yeah. For anybody else.
I'll say two different things. For myself, I told my husband, I was like, I'm going to go a little crazy and you're not going to say anything about it. I sold the company on May 20th. Actually crazy. My dad died when he was young and I was young in my 20s. And he died and his birthday was May 20th. And we closed the deal on May 20th, which was just sort of unbelievable to me. Just because he would have been super proud. Yeah. And I said to my husband on May 20th, I'm going to go a little crazy. And on December 31st, he's like, when is crazy going to end? Because I bought a whole bunch of things like jewelry and you know, I don't know. I just had some fun. I went shopping. Like, I love clothes. I love jewelry. And so I did that. But I think the thing that I did that I felt the best about, and I did it genuinely, selflessly, is I have, it makes me sad. You know, I have a brother who's really, really struggled. He's had really severe learning disabilities, and his full-time job is delivering pizza for Papa John's. He's just always struggled, and I was able to put money into trust for his family, and to make that phone call, like, he just was sobbing, and it was just, like, it was really nice to watch someone you love struggle that much and be able to do something about it. And I also took, you know, there were a bunch of people that had helped me along the way, people had invested in the past that didn't have a lot to invest and believed in me. And I, you know, you can give, like, $17,000 in a non-taxable gift. So I had a list of people, and I just started wiring money. And it's not that it was hugely impactful in their lives, but it was an acknowledgement of, like, you were behind me in the beginning, and I just want to thank you today. And it's not that it's going to make or break your life, but it felt good to do that because
okay, you just really cool. Officially kicked every man's ass that was on his seat.
I got a little tear in my eyes. I'm a weeper. I'm always a weeper.
I cry a lot. That's okay.
That's amazing. That's actually the best answer we've had so far. Everybody's had really dope answers, but that's really fucking cool.
Yeah. And it's really why we're doing this, right? Yeah. In a sense, it's like, I mean, it's, you know, giving back through.
One thing men do that women don't is we rate everything. Ah, she's first place, second place, third place.
Well, I'm definitely first place. I'm going to be sure. I'm going to hold that title for a long time.
My daughter's always like, Dad, it's not always a competition. I was like, yeah, but that was a good course. Yeah. Or like the cook will bring out food.
You in particular rate everything. Mike is like nonstop.
Nine out of ten.
You were the one who just said best. I didn't say that. I would have said that's a wonderful answer.
My son is super competitive. He's wedged between these two very precocious sisters. And I'll always say to him, J-Mo, like, not everything is competition. And he'll say, yes, it is, Mom. 100% it is.
And he's right.
Well, our recent competition was like Ronaldo versus Taylor Swift. Who's more important? And it's like, it makes him so angry.
Who is more important?
Taylor Swift.
And so I say Taylor Swift. Of course, he says Ronaldo. So his Christmas stocking, I put like Taylor is, you know, Woman of the Year in Time magazine. I mean, it like basically ruined his Christmas. And so, you know, one of my board members works for the NFL. It's like, do you know the impact that she's had on the NFL? Hundreds of millions of dollars. And he's like, that's not true. And I'm like, it is true. So anyway.
T-Swift.
T-Swift.
Ronaldo 10 years ago.
Let's ask the audience. Can you guys comment and tell us who's more important? You know what? You got to put Messi in there. Ronaldo,
all right,
Messi, or Taylor Swift? Should we put Drake in there, Mike?
I got a funny Drake story, but I'll tell you later.
Tell us.
Well, and if you had a superpower, and if two questions, if you had a superpower, would it be like Marvel superpower? And if you was president of the United States for a day and could make one rule, what would it be?
Why don't you just give her a third question too?
I'm gonna test. I have a third.
I'm gonna talk out of my ass, admittedly, because I don't know if this is not an answer I've prepared. I would say a superpower is if you could figure out how to turn it off at times. I think that being the best listener in the world would probably allow you to gain the most wisdom and have the most impact. And I think if I were, well, first of all, maybe I'll be president for 4 years or eight. You never know. I've thought about that at times.
Like, I'm both.
We need a female president someday. But I think if I were president for one day, God, I wish we could just get back to the facts and stop all the chatter. Just let's like stick with the facts.
Yes.
Like let's go down the middle. Let's make calm, rational decisions and stop all the stories around the facts. I would just love to shut down
Washington.
All of the BS. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if that's what I would do, but that would be one thing I would love to do as the president of the United States.
And do you really think about politics?
I have thought about it, but I think it's so complicated right now, unfortunately, as we all know. I do think that I, through building Beauty Counter and through representing hundreds of thousands of women now over the past 11 years and going from city to city across America, that I've had the ability to gain access to real America and real Americans and to listen to people on both sides of the aisle. And what I've learned is that in general, we do care about the same things and that we can find power in our collective voice. And I do think that the world would be a better place if there were more women in power. And I think there's a balance. There's an imbalance today. And I don't think it should be all women or all men, but I think that having a woman with emotional intelligence who can inspire and lead towards a better outcome, I think would be really amazing. Am I that person? I don't know. But I've thought about it.
Cool.
It's just kind of a nightmare business right now, as we all know.
You got my vote. I'm in.
Mine too.
Right. We'll see. I'll let you know if I ever run.
Mike had once thought about running for politics, but...
Did you?
I try to get my sister. You remind me a lot of my sister. She's a turn older. I think she's... She's had her birthday today. No, it's tomorrow. Shout out my sister's birthday.
Happy birthday.
And she, I think she turned 63. I'm not sure you're supposed to talk about a woman's age on a podcast. But
there you go. Being a man again.
But I actually tried to get her to think about running for president at one point. She gave it a lot of thought just because, same thing, she's traveled the world. She's traveled the country. She's a powerful woman, and she'd have been great. But
yeah.
By the way, both his sisters been on the cover of Forbes, kicked his ass. I think he got That's a little amazing. Article one time.
I have three sisters.
I was going to ask, you seem like curiosity is a big part of it also. And we have everyone that's on here, I think we've noticed like a strain of curiosity is one big thing. You want to talk about that?
Are you a reader?
You consider yourself, yeah, you said you were a reader.
I love to read. And I love documentaries, and I like fiction. I mean, I can read, you know, the trashiest novels and things. I read every night before I go to bed, even if I've had too much to drink. I just like to read. I think curiosity is everything. And I think that certainly in business, I feel like arrogance has no place in the world as far as I'm concerned. I'm like done with it. The minute you think you're important and you know more, you just aren't. I mean, you just really, really aren't. And I would say to my children, never assume you know more about a subject than the person with whom you guys all think you're really important. No. Maybe you are.
I think someone in this room is making your list for sure. I won't say who it is, but
well, it's a tough crowd, you all. But I always say to my kids, like, you know, never assume you know more about a subject than the person with whom you're speaking. Mm-hmm. Always ask questions. And I think you just learn a lot from people. Everyone's had different experiences. You know, the smartest people I know, and I've, you know, like you all, I've met some super interesting, powerful people in my life. The people that have achieved the most success in the world are the ones that are asking questions all day long. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the great fortune of having Bono as an investor in Beauty Counter and an ally. And I remember my first time meeting him, and I was so nervous. And he just asked me one question after the other. And I thought, here's someone who could be the most arrogant person in the world, and yet all he wanted to do, and yes, he's really funny and tells stories, but people that are really successful ask good questions all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They seek to learn, and they learn from younger people and older people and everyone in between.
Yeah.
Mike always says that. Shout out to Mike.
Yeah. Well, really, we're like intergenerational, right? Like, I mean, Mike and I have like kind of raised our families together, but like we have everybody from like 5-year-olds to like 85-year-olds, you know, at parties and in rooms, and it's super interesting.
You had kids from 5 to 85. No. Like, wow. Okay. I was like, I don't think you guys are that old.
We look good for age for guys that don't use a lot of product.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So we have a tradition on Business Untitled where we give our guest a gold coin.
An ounce of gold.
Oh. Who is it sponsored by?
Well, it's sponsored by JM Bullion, our first sponsor, Business Untitled's only sponsor. JM Bullion is the largest direct-to-consumer gold company, and they're awesome. They called us up. They said, we want to sponsor you. No formal contract, handshake. They sent us the gold coins. We give them a shout-out, and our guest gives us their ounce of gold. You've given a lot of ounces of gold today, but like one thing that you want to leave the listeners with, and you know our target audience are really underserved, want to be entrepreneurs, and so we thought we'd share our stories and share people's you know, our guest wisdom. And so here's your ounce of gold.
Thank you.
Today it's worth $2,300. In a year it's going to be worth $3,000. Gold is going higher. Mark my words.
It is. Thank you. That's an incredible gift.
He sends you 4 bitcoins to your crypto wallet.
Great. Then I'll take those too. I will. Absolutely. I'm invested in crypto and I'm trying to learn it. I would say, so whether you're a woman or man, if you are someone who's wanting to be an entrepreneur, and you feel that you're underrepresented or you don't have the confidence. First, I said this earlier, but I will always reiterate that I genuinely believe you have everything you need to be successful. You just got to dig deep and find that confidence. And that as you venture into the world of trying to raise capital or build a business or tell people about your ideas, know that you don't need people's validation to do what you want to do. You need to be willing to work your ass off for a very long time, but you'll never get the validation you seek from others. You need to be able to do this for yourself. And my mom, when I was a young woman, said to me, Greg, you are the cake and everything else in the ice will be the icing, but you need to build a strong foundation. Men, like wealth, all these things, that'll be icing on your cake, but like can you feel strong in your own personal foundation and be confident? Because cake in and of itself is really sweet. The icing is just the stuff on the top. And I think that especially women, we always are looking for other people to validate as opposed to just like owning who we are. So I would just say you've got this and just go for it and don't look back.
That might be the best ounce of gold we've done yet.
She's like,
I'm serious.
This is
that
a triple gold medalist right here.
Triple gold medalist.
And, you came in here to kick ass.
Yeah. No, I think that was an amazing ounce of gold. And I also think it's great to have a really badass woman entrepreneur on this show.
Yeah.
We'd love it if you thought of other people that might be interested in sharing their message, because we're really looking for badass women entrepreneurs to spread the word.
I 100% will. And thank you all for having me. I mean, it was when John Foley, my friend, called me and told me about you all. He and I have had, a lot of good conversations over the years. And I was excited to be here. So thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Shout out to John Foley.
John Foley.
All right. That's it, people. Another episode in the can. Business Untitled.